Lodge and Hopewell Gardens. Do all the things you wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 1-800-441-4410 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to FW Presents, the anthology show for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is the season two finale of Mountain Comics, where I look back at the comics I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. And joining me in the cabin this week is, once again this season, unprecedented, Gene Hendricks. Hi, Gene.
Hello, Rob. Thank you for having me back.
Have you been in the cabin this whole time? Where have you been? I don't understand.
For some reason, I got locked in the basement.
There is no basement, Gene. This is very upsetting.
Root cellar, then.
Yeah, there was a section under the porch where we stored the sailboat that we had. So maybe that's what it was.
And now I'm flashing to up. I hid under your porch because I love you.
Yeah, it's kind of got like a Chud feel to it, but that's for another podcast. But anyway, Gene, I'm very happy to have you back here for, again, the end of season two of Mountain Comics. And we're here to talk about something very special. Now, when you were here earlier in the season, we talked about Marvel Super Action number 37, which was, of course, a Marvel reprint title. And this time we're talking about Warren Presents number 9, and Warren Presents, for any of you who don't know what that is, and I would assume that's a lot of you, Warren Presents was sort of the omnibus magazine for Warren Publishing, which was run by Jim Warren, and they ran different installments in each issue. This particular book that we're here to talk about is called Empire Encounters Comics. And we'll explain why the word empire was thrown in there. I think we'll figure it out momentarily. but Gene, would you agree with me, in my estimation, that outside of Vampirella, which of course debuted in the pages of her own magazine from Warren magazines, like most of the history of Warren has just disappeared down the memory hole? Like I feel like hardly anybody remembers these magazines.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things. It was Warren was this kind of side publisher that had this variety of different magazines, but it's just something that no one seems to have latched onto. And really the only way I know about it is my dad. And I probably have told this story somewhere before, but when my sister and I were little, we went on vacation to Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, which is a beautiful farm country, very high concentration of Amish and Mennonites. So it's very picturesque, very history-oriented. But being the bratty kid I was, I saw, hey, Dad, there's a comic book shop on Route 30. Can we go? In the middle of this great family vacation. So he relented and he took us. And he bought, you know, I got, you know, actual comic books. He bought four Warren magazines because he remembered them from a kid. And one of those magazines was Creepy number 1.
Wow.
And I still have it. It's right in front of me, as a matter of fact. And for those that don't know, Creepy was Warren's Tales from the Crypt, to the point where it was in every story was introduced by Uncle Creepy, their crypt keeper. But you know, being a magazine, they didn't have to go by the comics code. So you had some really interesting stories in there. But Warren did science fiction. They did
Famous Monsters of Filmland.
Right. Yeah. And people recognize that title, but I don't think they ever connect it with Warren.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Jim Warren was just a big fan of comic books, and he wanted to create like kind of his own line of EC comics. And so much so that you just mentioned, he did Creepy, he did Eerie, and he basically staffed them with EC people that were kind of like, no, they weren't out of work, but these were guys that wanted to do horror, and horror had sort of fallen out of fashion thanks to the comics code. But he, as you mentioned, he decided to go around them by publishing magazines. And at the time, I mean, the early issues had work by Jack Davis, covers by Frank Frazetta, Joe Orlando, Al Williamson. I mean, he had these amazing roster of writers and artists, and he built this whole company kind of out of nothing, really. And I like to think of Jim Warren as, and this might sound like it's an insult, and it's not meant to be, but I kind of think of him as like the Roger Corman of comics, where he was a guy that built his own company with his own two hands, kind of trading in what most people would consider disreputable genres. I mean, Warren didn't do superheroes for the most part. They did horror, sci-fi. They did even some romance. The less said about that stuff, the better.
Yeah, they did westerns. They did love stories. I mean, he did everything that DC and Marvel were doing except the superheroes.
Right. And I mean, as the magazines went on, he would bring in newer artists. I mean, he gave a break to a young writer named Marv Wolfman.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. He gave a lot of work to Neil Adams, or I think relatively early on in his career as well. And a lot of these guys did amazing work for Warren because they weren't constrained by having to do superheroes or the comics code. They were able to address social issues in a lot of stories. And it was like, and I will say, when this mag, but in August of 1980, which is when I found this magazine, Empires Encounters Comics, I had never heard of them at all. I had no idea what they were because these magazines were not sold in my neighborhood. You know, I didn't, as I talked about in the previous episode with Michael Bailey on Rampaging Hulk, these black and white magazines did not show up in my local neighborhood. They just, none of the newsstands ever carried them. But when I was on vacation with my parents in the Poconos, there was this store, The Trading Post, which again I mentioned in just the previous episode, and they had a huge selection of not only comics but black and white comic magazines. They carried Rampaging Hulk, they carried Savage Sword of Conan, and they carried Warren's. So this magazine popped out at me because it had the word Empire in it. Because of course Empire, everybody knows in 1980 what that word means, and you know it was a sci-fi-y cover of a kind of a robot and a spaceship, and I was like, okay, this looks interesting, and it says right at the top, Star Wars, two inside scoops. So I'm like, okay, sure, you know. So I picked it up, and this was my introduction to Warren entirely. I had never known what they were about at all. And so this was the beginning of a real like love affair I had with these guys, and I started collecting their magazines whenever I could find them, which was hard to do again because I went home and I couldn't find them again. So it was like, you know, it was the kind of thing where if I saw them at a Comic-Con or at a comic book shop like you were just talking about, I would try and pick some of them up. I would try and buy the cheapest ones I could find, but these were pretty scarce. And of course, 1980, Warren was only a couple of years away from folding up shop.
Mm-hmm.
They started in the early 1960s, and they had a good run of the 60s and 70s. But by the 80s, they were kind of on their last legs, and all the magazines eventually, Creepy, Eerie, Vampirella, would get canceled. But I didn't know that in 1980, and still, this was all very exciting. But the reason I mentioned I compared Jim Warren to Roger Corman is that he was pretty unabashed about his jumping on trends, and Warren Presents was basically a reprint title where he would go and they would dip into their archives and collect a bunch of stories around a certain theme and put it between, you know, two covers, throw in some ads, which we'll get to in a moment. The ads.
I love the ads in this thing.
Oh, the ads. But clearly Jim Warren was like, look, the word empire means Empire Strikes Back. Kids want to read about Empire Strikes Back. So we'll call the magazine Empire Encounters Comics. The contents of this magazine have nothing to do with any of that stuff.
Right.
Nothing at all. They're just four sci-fi stories. But nevertheless, he was like, slap Empire on it. We'll give it a new cover. We'll run stories that we've already paid for. We'll stick a bunch of Captain Company ads. And bang, we've got a new magazine. And that's really what it was. But I didn't know all that in August 5th, 1980. I was just excited about this new thing that I was finding.
And, you know, for the age that it was, reprint titles, like the last time we talked, were big because there was no way that you were going to track down the previous issues.
Exactly.
So unless you were blessed with being able to get Warren mags regularly, neither of us were,
right,
then you don't know any different. You know, it's like, oh, I've never seen these stories before. They look great. So, you know, it works. It works for the publishing company because they're actually not spending anything else for content. They're printing. That's their entire cost for this. And, you know, 1980, The cover price on this thing's $1.75. They're making probably quite a bit of money off that cover price.
I must have really been attracted to this magazine that I spent that kind of money
yeah.
on this thing, because that was a lot of money to a kid in 1980.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, the comics back then were, what, 35 cents?
Something like that, 40 cents? Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I bought like four comics for that.
Right, yeah. So, but like you were saying, in 1980, as Empire, it's got the Star Wars name right on top, and you look at the back cover, and it's like, ooh, I like that ad. Give me.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
I would have done the same thing.
Yeah, I said this was one of those things that I remembered the image in my brain, because the copy that I have is not the original copy. I lost that over the years. But this cover was always in my brain, and I could never remember what it was, what it was from. I knew it was from something. And then once the sort of internet came along and I was able to look this stuff up, and then I found it, and I was like, that's it. That's the cover. And I was so excited. And then I tracked it down on eBay, and I bought it, and I've had it ever since. So, again, there are four stories in this magazine. And then, again, there's a whole bunch of ads, and we're going to talk about those ads in detail. But the first story is called The Rubicon, and it's reprinted from Creepy number 107. It's by Bud Lewis and Pepe Moreno. By the way, I should mention, a lot of these names that you're going to hear, these are people that didn't do work for DC Marvel Comics. You know, these were people that did other kind of stuff, and they didn't ever trade over into the superhero world. So you see a lot of the names you see in these Warren magazines you don't see anywhere else. So I'm going to give very brief synopses of these stories, because again, it's my reaction now is my same as reaction then. It wasn't so much the stories, it was the whole package that was so exciting. But anyway, the Rubicon is about a group of astronauts that are sent to some ruins where a number of other astronauts have disappeared. There they make a major discovery regarding the origin of mankind. So what do you think of the Rubicon? Because you're reading all these – you read all these for the first time, right, in this magazine?
Yeah, this was my first exposure to any of these. And when I read the Rubicon, it was almost like the pacing was very off. I mean, it's a very interesting story, but they seem to waste three pages in the beginning with setup and then rush through it the rest of the story. So I don't know if it was an editorial thing or what, but yeah, this also has probably my least favorite art in the issue.
Okay.
Not that it's bad, but even for Creepy, this would be kind of a little off model, really. But the theory behind it, ancient astronauts and stuff. I'm waiting for the guy from the History Channel. I'm not saying it was aliens, but it's aliens.
but it's aliens.
it's something that I have seen before in my life. I don't know how often it occurred in 1980. So I don't know how groundbreaking the idea of, oh, aliens came to Earth and we're essentially the Celestials from Marvel.
Right, yeah.
Genetically manipulated the species there to create a new race, a servitor race. But it was an interesting concept. I would have liked a little more on the background of Father What's-His-Face.
I forget.
Yeah, the only survivor of the previous expedition.
Right, the one that they find, yeah.
Right, who is, spoilers, who is the culprit as to why the previous expedition needed to call for help. Because he had to keep it a secret. He had to keep what they discovered there a secret, otherwise mankind would go bananas.
Yeah, it feels very Twilight Zone-y.
Yeah,
because it has this sort of like social commentary, but then it's certainly higher budget than what the Twilight Zone ever could have afforded. But that's the the benefit to being in a comic book. I actually like the artwork quite a bit, Pepe Moreno. I think he's got some nice line work and stuff like that. But yeah, it's funny that but the fact that this ran in Creepy shows you that by the near the end of the run of Creepy and Eerie, they were kind of like really going off brand.
Well, not really, because I can't remember which one it's in. One of the Creepies I have has a story about a vampire in space. and the undoing of the story, because there's always the twist in there, is the vampire, he's stowed away on this ship to get to another planet where they didn't have all the protections against vampires. Well, the other planet had a day-night rotation of an hour. So he's like, oh, you know, the sun just went down. I'm fine. An hour later, he's burnt to a crisp.
That sounds like a fun story. I don't think I've ever read that one.
Yeah. But I mean, it's in one of the two issues I have.
Okay. I think what I'm more thinking is that, like, after Star Wars, I get the feeling Warren was like, let's just jam space into every story we can.
Probably.
You know, it's a horror story, but we'll put it in outer space. Because it was like, you just hear about, you know, why are there astronauts in a magazine called Creepy? Couldn't you think of when Creepy started? It was all tombs and vampires and werewolves and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's a perfectly fine story. It's certainly not one of their best. I don't think it's that bad, but it's not not one of their greatest things. The second article is actually reprinted from Famous Monsters of Film in number 166 called The Empire Strikes Gold, which is just an article about The Empire Strikes Back. So that's how much Warren could repurpose this stuff. They were reprinting just text articles from Famous Monsters of Film Man, which is kind of amazing when you think that really? You could reprint this? It's almost like rerunning the news or something.
Yeah, but again, unless you had the Empire Strikes Back storybook, you weren't going to see some of these pictures of Yoda and the AT-AT and Chewie on Hoth and all this other stuff. You would see the movie and then that's it.
Right.
Maybe you get the Marvel Super Special, but that's about, you know, as close as you can come, and that's not actual pictures. That's, you know, the artist rendering.
Yeah, yeah, it was cool. I mean, you said when I was a kid, I couldn't read that stuff fast enough. You know, related to Star Wars. So yeah, they were smart. There's a reason why they blare the word Star Wars at the top of the cover and put the word Empire in the title to tell you everything you need to know. So the next story is a two-parter called Gotterdammerung, and it's from Eerie number 100 and 101 by Bud Lewis once again and Isidore Moniz. In a devastated future, two slave boys meet Jericho, a robot man, and another man named Judah. The four of them get on a spaceship and escape from the Earth. In part two, our heroes battle aliens trying to retake the Earth from them. During the fight, Jericho is severely injured, then transported to another human ship where one of our heroes' father is aboard. They fight off the aliens and are reunited as the story ends. In this whole magazine, this is my least favorite, this two-parter. I remember reading it as a kid, and I just was like, okay, whatever. And I read it not that long ago in preparation for this recording. I was like, yeah, whatever. Didn't do anything for me. The artwork is nice, but the rest of it, I just didn't care.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea for a story, but you can see precisely the parts of Star Wars that they've been grabbing for this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to the point where one of the kids, Chatto, is dressed like Luke Skywalker.
Yes. Yep.
So it's okay. Well, this guy's a half robot, so he looks kind of like a stormtrooper, but acts like Darth Vader. This guy over here is Han Solo. The ship they steal, as soon as I saw the picture of one of the ships, I'm like, oh, they stole the Millennium Falcon's cockpit.
Yeah. Yep.
So yeah, it is purely, this is popular, let's grab it.
Yeah, we'll spin the dial and come up with some variations of this. Yeah. And the fact that it's a two-parter, I'm kind of like, yeah, all right. It's fine, but it just didn't resonate with me. And like, unlike a lot of other comics that I read as a kid, my opinion didn't change of it over time. I was like, okay, yeah, it's basically the same thing. So the next story is called The Green, and it's from Creepy number 96 by Bruce Jones. Everybody knows who that is. And Louis Bermejo. A young man, a green, gets assigned for transporting ammunition through space rather than going into battle like he had hoped. As months pass by on their long mission, his commanding officer tells him tall tales of their destination, a planet occupied by beautiful women who continuously have sex with them, as well as the fabulous food and exciting battles they will get into there. When they finally arrive, the green realizes that it was all a lie, and it was just a story his commander told him so he wouldn't go crazy on the long trip there. This is my favorite one. I really enjoyed The Green. I think this is a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is also my favorite. I mean, it's the idea behind this one is just terrific. It's like, okay, kid, I know you don't want to be here. I know you want the glamorous battlecruiser job, but we got to do this. And I got to keep you occupied. I got to keep your mind engaged with the mission. So here's what we got. And it's really creative, the stuff he comes up with.
Yeah. I know. I have to think about what, obviously I have no memory of what my reaction was to reading this at 9 years old.
Ooh.
Because, I mean, it's certainly not as explicit as Warren would get in 1994 and some of the other magazines, but it's definitely lurid. Luis Bermejo does a nice job of sort of channeling Frank Frazetta in these nubile women mm-hmm. that we see in these fantasy sequences, and the sequences where he's fighting bad guys is very Frazetta-ish. But I really thought this was a lot of fun because it's funny. I mean, just the idea of, like, you know, what's going to keep this guy entertained? I know I'm going to make him sound like he's Flash Gordon and he's going to love it. And it's a Shaggy Dog story, of course, because none of this is really true, but it's told with a lot of wit. And that's not surprising. I'm a fan of Bruce Jones as a writer. And so I thought this was just, you know, very, very charming.
Yes. Yeah. It was a fun read. And I love the last panel where the kid finally accepts what's going on. And so the sergeant starts to tell him the stories all over again.
Right. And you see the landscape they're sitting on, and it couldn't be more desolate. Like, mm-hmm. it looks like they're just on the moon. There's just space and there's just absolutely nothing, which, again, I think is kind of reminds me like a little bit of the sort of verisimilitude that the original Alien movie had, is that those guys are not like explorers. They're just workmen that just happen to work in outer space.
They're truckers.
They're truckers. And as much as outer space seems romantic and like a grand adventure to us, eventually when we're in space all the time, it will become very routine. And so that's what these guys remind me of. They're just kind of guys that just happen to work in outer space, and it's all kind of boring. It's, you know, really cool. I like this one a lot. And then the final story is Gravity Field from Vampirella number 76 by Bob Toomey and Pepe Moreno. A group of astronauts, again with the astronauts, on a mission in deep space come across a black hole. One of the astronauts kills one of the others, not under his own control, and they throw his corpse into the hole. He returns alive soon after. The black hole starts speaking to them, revealing that it has caused the murder, then brought the man back to life. Lonely, the black hole asks the astronauts to bring the black hole back home with them, which they do. what about this one?
This is just odd. I mean, mainly from the guy that's taking the ship hostage, and this just puts a date stamp right on it because he's from the Provisional Irish Republican Army. And he's taking over a British spaceship. So, yeah, this is precisely what was going on in the news at the time.
Right.
But then, you know, everything happens and no one knows what to do. It's like, oh, yeah, I shot this guy. I don't remember what I did. Maybe you should lock me up. Well, I can lock you up, but we're not going to get anywhere because that was my navigator. Okay. It's just stuff going to get thrown out there. But, yeah, I'm wondering how the black hole is going home with them.
Yeah, I mean, you have to wrap your head around the idea of a sort of sentient black hole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of interesting. It's got the end. I like the ending a lot. It's just kind of this, you know, where it leaves you sort of halfway through. You're like, oh, okay, they're going to just sort of tug this black hole back to Earth. How's that going to work? I don't know. Yeah, it's a little very strange. So those are the four or five, I guess, stories of this magazine. And like I said at the top of the show, these stories, except for The Green, which again I really like, none of them left a huge impression on me. They even still kind of didn't. But that wasn't what made this magazine memorable. And one, the genius element that Jim Warren brought to his magazines and what made them probably very profitable is the ads.
Mm-hmm.
He came up with – he had a separate company called Captain Company. And at least a third of any given Warren magazine was filled with ads for stuff. The coolest, nerdiest stuff that you could get. And when I saw these ads, my mouth started to water because it was all stuff that I either had, wanted to get, or stuff that I didn't know existed.
Yeah, now, that was the main thing with me. It's like, okay, yeah, I've heard of this. I had that. What's this?
Yeah.
Where'd that come from?
Now this magazine is limited to just Star Wars stuff, which, of course, again, at 9 years old, that was ground zero. That was my interest, was all Star Wars stuff. Now, these are all Star Wars ads. The other Warren magazines, they sold ads for Power Records, paperback books, back issues of Warren magazines, posters. Everybody seen that famous life-size Vampirella poster? I mean, it was all the kind of stuff that I had never seen in the wild, and it just drove me nuts that you could order this stuff. You could just pull out the order form in the back of the magazine and order this stuff from them. And so Warren, by having these, like, every magazine that they released was a profit driver on top of it just being the magazine they could sell. But then they could get probably lots of money from the orders people made from these mags. So it was like getting people to pay for your catalog, which is a genius move.
Oh, yeah.
So the back cover to this magazine, we'll start at the back cover, is a full color ad for the Empire Strikes Back toys. And again, this was everything I wanted. You've got the Tauntaun, the Bespin Cloud Car, the Snowspeeder, the carrying cases, the Star Destroyer, IG-88 figure. I mean, it's I don't know. It was just, you look at this and you're like, I want all of this stuff.
Yeah, this was the staple of the kind of things I would be playing with at this time. I had the Tauntaun, I had the Snowspeeder, that was it. But in fact, I think this is not the Tauntaun I had, because the one I had the little compartment underneath where you could stick Luke in.
Oh, you had the one with the slit in its belly? Mm-hmm. I never had that one. Okay. Okay. On the inside cover, there's an ad for Star Wars toys, and it says the laser pistol, the laser rifle, the TIE fighter, Star Wars poster art set, a 12-inch Darth Vader figure, the Darth Vader action kit, the Darth Vader van kit. Everybody remembers that. The R2-D2 van kit and the Luke Skywalker van kit, because, you know, that's how these guys got around, was in vans. We all remember that from Star Wars.
Of course. Well, it's just like the Matchbox Daily Planet van that had Superman changing on side of it.
Right, yeah, exactly. Exactly. There was an ad for back issues of Warren magazines, which, again, that was something that Warren did that, of course, DC and Marvel rarely did. I mean, you could buy old treasuries through their ads, but DC didn't sell back issues of their magazines, so Warren offering old issues was really cool. So then you get to the back section of the magazine, and it's all just Star Wars stuff. There's a Millennium Falcon model, the Imperial Troop Transporter, the Millennium Falcon, which is probably hands down my favorite toy of all time, the Millennium Falcon. I had that as a kid, and I played with it till it fell apart. I don't even think it really fell apart. I think I just had it until I gave it away to my cousin, but boy, did I love that thing.
Well, pieces of mine fell apart. I could never keep that radar dish on.
Yeah, right. There's an ad for the Star Wars Electronic Action Battle Computer. Did you have this, Gene?
No, until I read this magazine, I had never even heard of it.
Oh, man, I had this one as a kid. I went everywhere with this little game, and it was just a strategy game, and all the graphics are just these little red dots, and you're basically supposed to be an X-Wing fighter in a dogfight with TIE fighters.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, it's basically like a electronic tic-tac-toe, but with, you know, with the Star Wars, sort of Star Wars brand on top of it, and it made little sounds. Like, when you killed the TIE fighter, it made a little sound. I have such fond memories of playing hours this game. I just loved it. I mean, it was just so fun. I carried it everywhere. It's like a modern cell phone. You know, I just had it all the time. And so I love that I get to see it again. If I ever feel like I'm kind of curious how much it must cost on eBay. Probably pretty penny in the box or something.
Most likely, yeah.
Yeah. But boy, did I love the thing. There's an ad for a radio-controlled Sandcrawler, which I had. And then there's the all-new Star Wars action figures. And there's a little panels of all the new figures. Greedo, R-54, Snaggletooth, Death Star Droid, Boba Fett, Hammerhead, Luke Skywalker in his X-Wing outfit, and the Walrus Man. And then there's the Star Wars action figures, which is, it's like the original 12. And each of them get their own little write-ups.
Yeah.
Which I love. I mean, like, I imagine, like, working for Captain Company must have been kind of fun. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, just putting an ad like this together must have been interesting, because you have – and the Star Wars figures were groundbreaking, yes. But they weren't all that exciting to look at in a picture. You know, I mean, I can – it's different like when you have the vehicles where you've got a few of the figures around it and you can pose them like they're doing something. Just a picture of Obi-Wan Kenobi, not super exciting. So this ad copy, you know, it's really necessary to draw you in a little more.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, I love that they each get their own – I mean the Death Star Commander and the Tusken Raider and all stuff like that. And then there's two pages of kind of the more kind of lower – not so much toy stuff, but merchandise. There's poster arts. There's pins. There's a book, The Story of Star Wars. There's charm bracelets, watches, stick pins, a Chewbacca pendant, which I had. I remember my Chewbacca pendant. A Darth Vader belt buckle, which is boss. I really wish I had that. It's just a big Darth Vader head. That looks cool as hell.
Yeah, I mean, they've got earrings in here. And that shows you that Star Wars was not a boy's thing. Because my sister loved Star Wars growing up. You know, with Princess Leia being the take charge woman of action kind of thing. She can't stand Star Trek, but loves Star Wars.
So yeah, for everybody.
Yeah.
There's Halloween masks. You can go as C-3PO, Stormtrooper, which is sold out. I love that. I love when they would stamp sold out on stuff because it really gave you the sense you had to order it fast.
Yeah.
It's going to sell out. Chewbacca and Darth Vader. I went as at least two of them. I have pictures of myself as Chewbacca and as Darth Vader. Two different years. So these things definitely worked on me. There's an ad for the record, a poster, a bunch of T-shirts, some diecast stuff. I had a diecast Millennium Falcon, which I love. The Dewback. Did you have the Dewback?
I had the Dewback, yes.
Okay.
It was another thing like the Tauntaun where you had the hatch in the top of it. And you would stick the legs of the Stormtrooper in. And then for some reason, you were supposed to believe that his legs were brown on the outside of the saddle.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's the Star Wars Cantina set, which I had. I still – it's funny. You know, this we're talking 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago at this point. But I remember my dad buying me the Star Wars Cantina set, and it was on a weekend when my mom was working, and my dad had to, like, do something in the garage, and he needed me to be, like kind of leave him alone while he did this thing. And he bought me the Star Wars Cantina set and he charged me with putting it together myself.
Oh, wow.
And that kept me entertained all afternoon because it was all built on with like rubber band technology, you know, where like you put your action figure's foot on a little switch and it moves the door open. And it came with the Cantina creatures. It came with the four aliens. So, and this backdrop, it was very exciting. I still remember sitting on the steps to our basement, putting this thing together while my dad worked on whatever he was working on. It's amazing. So many things have happened since then, but I still remember that.
Yeah, I didn't have the Cantina scene, but I did have the Droid Factory.
I didn't have the Droid Factory. Yeah.
The Droid Factory was great because it was the only way you could get a tripod R2-D2.
That's right.
But it also had all these other parts that you could use to build – like the Treadwell droid, or just randomly put them together and make a droid of your own. It was fun. That's what I used I used as Jabba's dungeon from Return of the Jedi.
Makes sense.
Where the droids were being tortured because, hey, there's already pieces of them in here. That must be what's going on.
Yeah, I love kids' imaginations. They just make stuff together. You know, they just put it together. It doesn't quite look like the thing I need, but it's fine. This works out. It's great.
Yeah.
And then the final page on the inside is you can order back issues of Warren Presents, which is in they talk. There's a Star Wars Spectacular, a Close Encounters, Future World Comics, Star Quest Comics, Lord of the Rings, Galactic Wars Comics, Ring of the Warlords, which seems like you're just taking a bunch of words and smashing them together to make a different thing. UFO and Aliens, Alien Invasion, and then Aliens Illustrated. And so, like I said, they never missed a trick.
You know?
I mean, they were like any word from pop culture that we can slap on this cover, we have some stories to make a magazine out of it. And it's just, again, it's like it's a brilliant marketing move to just have all this material lying around. Just keep reprinting it because, as you said, if you missed it the first time, you never saw it again. So, it's new to you.
Yeah, exactly. And we should point out that the Lord of the Rings magazine is the adaptation of the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Which was, that was one of those things that when I finally saw it on VHS, it just blew my mind. It's like, wow, someone actually had the audacity to make this? And that was many, many decades before Peter Jackson thought of it.
Yes. And then on the inside cover, there's one final ad for more Empire Strikes Back stuff. And these are more of the figures. And like you said, it's just these shots of the figures by themselves. And there's Bosk and FX7 and Leia in her Bespin outfit, IG-88, the Bespin guard, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, my childhood from 1977 through 1983 was pretty much devoted to getting every one of these figures. Were you that kind of collector? Were you like I had to have them all kind of person? Or did you not so much?
Not so much. I had enough. I had the main characters. I had, I think, three different versions of Han Solo because I had the vest, I had the jacket, and I had the Hoth gear. But I liked the vehicles and the play sets. So, like, this Imperial Attack Base, I had that. Every winter, that would go outside with me along with my AT-AT so I could redo the Battle of Hoth in the snow. But yeah, I had an X-Wing, obviously, because, anyone that had Star Wars stories had an X-Wing, but my main transportation for Luke was the Y-Wing, and that's because the Y-Wing, you could actually put your R2-D2 figure in it. It didn't have the button R2 to open the wings.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. That's right.
That's what Luke... Well, in my universe, flew a Y-Wing.
But, makes sense.
Yeah. But I have a funny story about this. 1983. Friend of mine, Frank, his dad, he was one of these collectors. He's one of the ones that had to have everything. So he had pretty much every Star Wars figure except like six. So the one day his dad took him out and he said, "Hey, listen, I know you need to complete your collection, so I'm going to take you to the Toys R Us and get any Star Wars figure you want." This was the day that the Return of the Jedi line came out.
Oh, boy.
But his dad was a man of his word, so Frank got, I think, 30 new figures.
Oh,
he had everybody from Return of the Jedi.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But see, I wasn't quite to that level. I would use what I had, even mixing in my G.I. Joes with the Star Wars figures. My superpowers was a little on the big side for that. But
a little scaled up.
Yeah, but they could make an appearance every now and again. But you ask my sister about when I would play Star Wars, and she will tell you horror stories from her point of view, because I didn't play in my room only. If I was serious about this, I took over the living room, and. It wasn't just one afternoon. It was like, okay, I'm done for now. Nobody touch anything. I will be back to play this after dinner.
Luke has to complete his training. Yeah. Don't anybody touch any of this stuff.
And I don't know what it was. I was obsessed with the carbon freezing scene from Empire because I had Slave One. And Slave One came with the carbon frozen Han Solo.
That's right.
Well, our coffee table was, the more or less the perfect size for like a landing pad. Picture the Imperial landing platform on Endor. That's mainly what was in my head. So the Millennium Falcon would land there, the Y-Wing would land there, etc. Well, for some reason, I don't understand my own brain sometimes. The end of the landing pad was the carbon freezing chamber. And Han Solo was a klutz and would always fall off it. And, oh, here he is. He's carbon frozen again. I don't know. But that's the kind of thing. Looking at these ads, brings that back to me. It's like, yep, that's the kind of stuff I would do.
Yeah, I mean, that said, this was really, like, this magazine was, you know, like, it was sort of reconfirming your kids thing, you know, because it was, like, offering you all the toys that you wanted, but then it was also, a lot of this material was above my age, you know, I mean, especially that Green story.
Oh, yeah.
I'm 9 years old. I shouldn't be reading something like that. And I mentioned in the 7th anniversary episode of Fire and Water, where I talked about there was a Warren magazine, an issue of their 1994 series that was really startling to me because it had, like, full-on sex in it. And I was, like, 12 when I read that. And I was like, oh, my God, you can have this in a comic book? I didn't know that. You know what I mean? And so I get – every time I could find a Warren, I bought one. But it was – I didn't see him very much. And so they became this kind of, like, forbidden thing that I could only find every so often. And this magazine, to my memory, which is not always the greatest, but to me, my memory, this is the beginning of the Warren relationship. And I have gone on to buy a bunch of Warren magazines. I have a bunch of old ones. You've given me some of them. And so I love going back and reading them. And some of them have been reprinted. There are deluxe reprints of Creepy and Eerie and Vampirella. And I like the Dynamite, I think, does Vampirella because that's who owns her now.
I believe so, yeah.
And they actually reprint the ads, which is great because they know that that's part of the appeal. Is seeing the whole magazine from beginning to end. And Warren would run editorials and stuff. I mean, he was really kind of the adult version of Marvel Comics, and he was the Stan Lee of the company because he would issue his opinions on things and stuff like that. And I think I've mentioned on other episodes Tomorrow's Warren Companion Book, which tells the story of the company from beginning to end with extensive interviews with everyone that ever worked for the company, is one of my favorite, like, I feel silly for saying this, it's one of my favorite books of all time because it's so well done, it's so complete, and it really gives you the sense of, like, what it was like to work for these guys and what it was like to work for Jim Warren, and it's just a great, great book. If anybody out there, if you want to just learn about this company, pick up The Warren Companion from Tomorrow's. It's a great book, but this is really one of my most beloved Mountain Comics because it was just introducing me to a whole new world that I did not know existed. And so it was like, oh my God, it would be great to say that, like, this magazine was, like, one of Warren's best ever. And it isn't. It's just a reprint magazine with some stuff slapped together, but it didn't matter because it was the beginning of a whole other trip. And I just love this magazine to death.
Yeah. It's interesting to read this because you're very similar to me in that we were focused on the superhero side of things.
Yes.
Even the Marvel and DC Western and war tales, it wasn't all that appealing as far as I was concerned. Is I want that four-color superhero thing. My very first comic book was an issue of The Incredible Hulk. Mm-hmm. So that's – and, you know, that got reinforced on television, seeing – the Bill Bixby, Lou Ferrigno series, and the cartoons and all this. So finding these non-code-approved magazines with these different tales, and I think that's why my dad bought them, because he wanted to show me that there were other options out there. And it was great. And being, you know, someone who likes classic horror movies, Creepy was right up my alley. So it was nice, but I never really read any, except for that one vampire story I already talked about, I never really read any of their sci-fi stuff. So this was a great read. No, I didn't think that they were masterpieces, but it was interesting to delve into that for a little while.
Yeah. Yeah, and I said it makes me sad to think that so much of it is just, I think, like, forgotten. I mean, you can buy a lot of these old Warrens on eBay for pretty cheap. You know, there doesn't even seem to be, like, much of a collector's market for them, which I'm actually thankful for. I'm kind of glad that the prices aren't astronomical because it means you can get decent reading copies for a good price, and you can still find them at conventions and stuff. I said there's a lot of really great material out there, and they had a huge line of magazines. I mean, they produced dozens and dozens of different titles, hundreds and hundreds of issues. I mean, Creepy ran until about 130. Vampirella ran something similar, and Eerie and stuff like that. So I don't know. I love all the stuff. I've talked about it. Like, there's other podcasts I'd like to do if I had more time. Like, of course, there's my beloved Omega Men podcast, which I'll never get to. But, like, I would do a Warren podcast if I had the time. That would be nearly the top of my list of, like, a history of Warren. Because I just don't think hardly anybody really knows it beyond people our age. And even a lot of people our age don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to be able to introduce a lot of this stuff to, like, a new generation. Because I think there's a lot of really cool stuff. But,
oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I said it's a terrific magazine. Again, it's one of my most beloved Mountain comics. So I think that's going to do it for Warren Presents. Gene, thank you for coming back this season. Again, unprecedented to make two appearances here in the cabin.
Yeah, I promised to actually leave this time.
All right, fair enough. Well, I'm packing up for the winter. We're gonna come back in the springtime. So before we sign off, where can people find you on the internets?
Well, the easiest place to find me would be every Thursday at thehammerstrikes.com. That's my geeky blog, which I put out once a week. And it's a very wide range of topics. It's whatever happens to pop into my head that I want to talk about. As of this recording, the most recent one was in regards to the unfortunate passing of Stan Lee earlier this week. But like my daughter asks, you know, how old was he? He was 95. What'd he die of being 95?
Mm.
So it wasn't exactly what I expected, still sad. Or I could go off on a claymation Christmas or Halloween special, or just generally, you know, random stuff out there that looks at Star Wars in another way. You never know. I also kind of do podcasts. It's a little tough time-wise anymore. But anything I do can be found at the Two True Freaks Network. That's TrueFreaks. And I have the Hammer Podcast, which is the vocal version of the blog. Watch that space, because there may be something in the new year coming that people might be interested in.
Cryptic.
Yes. Well, hey, you got to entice them. I also do the Quantum Cast with my buddy Adam Worth, all about the Kevin Bacon of the Marvel Universe, the superhero Quasar. And I do Anime Freaks with Dr. Bill Robinson, where we look at classic and modern anime and give you our opinions on them. The last two, Quantum Cast and Anime Freaks, are basically on hiatus right now because of my co-hosts having even busier lives than I do. So we may get back to them at some point, but in the meantime, you know, check out the blog. You may find something interesting.
Very cool. I said we'll have that link in the show notes. So again, Gene, thank you for coming by again. I appreciate it. And thank you for indulging me on this one, because I know you're like one of the few other Warren fans that I know of, but you hadn't read this one. So yes. I appreciate you reading this to join me to talk about this issue, because again, this one is – I have such an affection for this magazine. So I appreciate you giving it a spin.
And thank you for allowing me to give it a spin. It is anytime I get to read new to me Warren, it's a good day.
Very cool. All right, everybody. Well said. That is going to do it. Now I'm going to play some podcast promos. And because this is the season ender episode of season two of Mountain Comics, I'm going to end this one like I did last season with some listener feedback. So again, listen to some podcast promos and I'll be right back.
Professor Zoom Yukinori led an ongoing expedition through his favorite single issue comic book stories from the Bronze Age of DC Comics. With unique celebrity guest perspectives to set this program apart from other comic book review podcasts.
Solomon Grundy, don't understand.
Entity Terra Man.
I'm not following either.
Bizarro, totally get it.
I intend to participate in your podcast show of wonders.
As if I wasn't nervous enough.
Little Professor Man, mansplaining again.
Accessing files.
Experience the wonder.
Bizarro, what in tarnation did you do?
Adios, partner. Me am Bizarro Terra Man.
Goodbye.
Of the Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show.
Watch out, you square brain varmint.
Only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
All right, as promised, since this is the season two finale of Mountain Comics, we are going to do listener feedback, and we're going to go with feedback all the way from season one, the final episode of that season, which was episode 10, Super Friends number 8 with Zoom Yukinori, since we didn't get to do, obviously, listener feedback at that episode, since it was the last one of season one. So we got comments from Zoom Yukinori, Gord Toten, Ryan Daly, Ange, Chris Franklin, Sphinx Magoo, Keith Bowman, Max Traver, Ward Hill Terry, and Alan W. Wright, who says, a great last episode for the season of Mountain Comics, Rob and Zoom. I suppose a lot of us have the equivalent of Mountain Comics. I used to vacation in a trailer park between Sauby Beach and the town of Wearton, famous only for Wearton Willie, Canada's albino answer to Punxsutawney Phil. Yes. Sometimes I'd bring a stack of comics with me. Others I'd purchase in the variety stores, five and dime stores, and smoke shops in the town and villages surrounding the trailer park. It was up there that I first discovered the X-Men. I know I bought the Strange Sports Story Digest you covered up there, too. I love the Mountain Comics feature because it's a window into a past that's now as far removed from our times as 1955 Hill Valley was from Marty's own time. And I first saw Back to the Future up there in Owen Sound, the nearest place with a proper movie theater. Thank you so much, Alan. Yeah, I've said before I was a little concerned that this show might be like way too niche for people to really enjoy because it's so specific to me talking about my vacations. But of course, most people I know have brought comics on vacation, and that was like a big moment for them. So you could just transpose whatever vacation you went on with your comics. It's the same thing. So thank you so much for the comment. My pal David Gutierrez comments, you're hibernating this show? Well, yes, I did it after season one, and now we're doing it again after season two. Sorry, David, I just feel like the show has to take a little bit of a break over the winter and come back in the spring. We'll get to that again in a moment. So, Mac, now we're moving on to the comments for episode 11, which was the first one from this season, Captain America Battles Baron Blood with Derek William Crabb. We got comments from Ryan Daly, Ange, Ice D, Chris Franklin, Ido Bosnar, Martin Gray, Ward Hill Terry, and Keith Bowman, who says, so glad this is back. Like I've mentioned before, this podcast holds a special place for me since my family had a cabin in the Pocono Mountains near Big Boulder, Jack Frost. Jack Frost, it's Bob Dylan's handle. It's another connection. And I also spent my summers in the Poconos during the late 70s and early 80s. We would stop by and buy groceries near our cabin, and I always get a few comics to help pass the time. Since we are about the same age, I am sure we were buying a lot of the same books. Listening to this podcast always brings such back great memories and puts a smile on my face. Can't wait for the next episode. Thank you, Keith. Yeah, it's an amazing thought that like you were probably buying comics at the same stores at almost the same time I was. I didn't run into a lot of kids up in the Poconos, just generally, and I certainly didn't run into other ones that were like buying comics. I tended to be in those newsstands, and I don't remember like having to elbow kids out of the way to get other comics. But you must have like literally been in the same spaces, so that's amazing to me. Now, I haven't been able to track down your email, Keith, so if you're listening to this, please contact me. I would love to have you on the show just so we could talk about maybe visiting the same stores and see if you have some of the same memories I do. But anyway, thank you so much for commenting. I appreciate it. Max Traver says, yes, the return of Mountain Comics. Rejoice. This may very well have been how I first encountered this story as well, if dim memory can be said to do anything like serve. I do recall my group of friends being appropriately stunned by Cap's dispatching of Baron Blood. I remember Union Jack making his way into our outdoor live-action games of superheroes for 7 months afterward. Great issue. Great show. Thank you very much, Max. I appreciate it. And yeah, I love the way Cap gets rid of Baron Blood in that story, too. Pretty hardcore, even for Captain America. So comments on episode 12, which was Marvel Super Action number 37 with Gene Hendricks, of course you just heard. Comments from Brian Linton, Max Traver, Ward Hill Terry, Chris Franklin, who says, fun discussion. I think I only had one Marvel Super Action, but had several Marvel Superheroes issues and bought every Marvel Tales I could find, especially when they started reprinting the Lee Ditko and Lee Romita runs. Marvel Tales survived into the late 80s, way past the prime of these books. The word-to-word balloon transition to Marvel Comics is something I never really thought of, but man, that would be awkward in real life, wouldn't it? As for John Buscema, the man literally wrote the book on how to draw the Marvel way. Okay, Stan wrote it, but the art's old John. So after Kirby and maybe Romita, he is the look of Marvel to me. Yeah, I had that book, Chris. I loved it. And yeah, Buscema, to me, when you think of Marvel Comics, in a lot of ways, you think of John Buscema. And we got a comment from Gothos Mansion. I didn't have this particular issue, and thanks for revisiting one of Marvel's reprint titles. I always enjoyed these when I was getting into comics, since they gave me a chance to read up on the history of the characters I enjoyed. He mentions that he also bought Marvel Superheroes and Marvel Tales, just like Chris. He says, the Lee Ditko reprints appeared at the same time as the Roger Stern, John Romita Jr. run on Amazing Spider-Man, so I discovered the two best runs in Spider-Man history at the same time. I always hoped DC would follow Marvel's lead and have regular Batman and Superman reprint books, but they never did. I was wondering, when you two mentioned that a lot of important stuff in the story happened off camera, if the reprint was edited, but it didn't seem to be the case as you revealed later on. I know Marvel trims some stuff in reprints on occasion. Yeah, going back to your previous point, it is kind of amazing that DC never did Batman or Superman reprint titles. I mean, they did Treasuries and they did Digest and they did the 100-page specials, but they didn't have ongoing reprint books the way Marvel did. That's interesting. You would think that they, especially Superman, at the very least, would have been a license to print money. So it's kind of curious. Anyway, thanks everybody for the comments on that episode. Now moving on to episode 13, which is Marvel Team-Up number 111 with Greg Arujo. We've got comments from Siskoid, Tim Price, and Gothos Mansion, once again, who says, I enjoy how the series spotlights regular comics that probably wouldn't be covered otherwise. I agree with most of your points on this issue. I enjoyed Herb Trimpe's art on the Hulk, but I think he lacked the fluidity in his character movements that is a requirement for a Spider-Man artist. Yeah, I think that's a good point. He says, I enjoyed most of J.M. DeMatteis' MTU issues. DeMatteis did pull the doppelganger card in a later issue of Marvel Team-Up with the real Spider-Man not appearing. To avoid spoilers, I won't mention the issue number. Yeah, I'm worried about spoiling a 30-year-old comic. One of the fun things about collecting Marvel Team-Up, as well as DC Comics Presents and Brave and the Bold, was being introduced to characters I wasn't familiar with. Anyway, Rob, do you really not have the conclusion to this issue? Come on, dude. Marvel Team-Up back issues are not very expensive at all. In fact, I gave away a duplicate of MTU 112 to a friend just the other day. Get the conclusion and see what happens. Yeah, I actually do have the comic now, and I haven't gotten around to reading it. For shame. But even if I had read it, I would not have covered it on Mountain Comics because I try to keep those shows similar to how I experienced the comic at the time. And so I was experiencing that comic by itself, and I didn't know the conclusion at the time. So that's the way I wanted to do the show. But yeah, I do have the follow-up issue, and I do want to read the conclusion of that story since it's so bonkers and fun. Comment from Chris Franklin. Fun show. I definitely met a lot of characters in the team-up titles as both Marvel and DC. Nowadays, folks can just find a wiki site to look up even the most obscure of IPs, but back in the day, the team-up title was the way to go. Nice to hear Greg enjoy a comic for once. I just listened to his and Sean's episodes on Secret Wars 2, numbers 3 and 4. Great shows, but I felt so sorry for them. I hear you, Chris, but, you know, they're doing that show of their own choice, so they know what they were setting themselves up for. Regarding episode 14, which is Batman number 341 with the legendary Jerry Conway, we got a lot of comments on this one, no surprise. Comments from Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Sphinx Magoo, Joe X, Chris Franklin, Boston Moss, Siskoid, Wardell Terry, and Edo Bosnar, who says, oh, wow, wonderful episode. Always love it when a creator joins in on the discussion, especially when it's a legend like Jerry Conway. In fact, this is at least the second time you've had him on the show. Maybe it's time to see if he wants to launch his own podcast on the network. As Jerry knows, anytime, anywhere, of course. And I actually think this is our fourth appearance, Jerry's fourth appearance on the network, I believe. Shag interviewed him, and of course he was in our Fire and Water number 100, and they did an episode of Treasury Cast with me, and now this one. So I think this is his fourth appearance. So one more, and I think he gets a free dinner at Subway or something like that. Anyway, it was awesome to have Jerry on, of course. I got a comment from Earth 2 who says, Jerry Conway, awesome. Love hearing his insights, not just on this issue, but on Irv Novik and other artists. We'd love to hear him on an episode discussing his greatest creation, Power Girl, sorry, Shag, or his All-Star Comics run, or Secret Society of Supervillains run, or his interactions with Roy Thomas. Sorry, I am fanboy geeking here. Thank you for preparing this episode, Rob, and this series, which is reminiscent of my childhood road trips as a kid looking for comic books I couldn't find locally. Some real gems on those trips. Well, thank you, Ritu. Yeah, and it was, of course, it would be great to talk about Jerry on any of the stuff he's done. It would be great. Again, we could call this show Conway's Corner. So, Jerry, if you're listening to this, you're probably not, but if you are, you want to do a show, the door's always open. And then there was one other thing I wanted to address. It was a comment from Boston Moss where he says, one question about this episode, what's the significance of the closing outro music? Usually I get the association, but not with this one. I don't even remember what song that was, but I guarantee there is no association. As I mentioned on previous episodes, we didn't have a TV in the cabin. It was by choice. You could bring one, and you could plug it in and get reception and stuff, but we chose not to bring a TV because the whole point was to, like, be outside and you know, not just sit inside and watch TV. So we had a radio. So the two defining things of those trips for me were reading comics and listening to music. And that's why I have – not only do I have Mountain Comics, I have Mountain Songs. I actually have a playlist on my iTunes of that's all Mountain Songs, which are songs that makes me think of those times up in the Poconos. And so I end every episode of Mountain Comics with a song that was a hit on the radio at the time. Every so often I get lucky where there's like some like weird accidental connection. Like for the episode we did with with Gene, where the Marvel Super Action, which is the Avengers story, which takes place all in New York. I think I ended that show with the boy from New York City by Manhattan Transfer. But most of them, there is no connection. The song you're going to hear at the end of this episode, there's no connection other than it was a big hit on the radio at the time. So, and I have fun digging those up because these are a lot of these songs I've never heard. I haven't heard for many years. But yeah, no connection to the content of the show. It's just sort of presenting the song from that time. So thank you for asking, Boston, because again, some people probably are a little confused as why the shows end the way they do. Feedback for episode 15, which is Iron Man 200 with Sean Ross. We've got comments from Brian Linton, Mark Ryan, Chris Franklin, Luke Giaconetti, Tim Price, Siskoid, and Divius Gutierrez, who says, "What a terrific show that hits my personal sweet spot. That brand spanking new armor worked its magic, and because I snatched up the issue. Even then, I could spot some of the wonkier points brought up on the show, but man, I love this comic. And then armor really sold it. The new color scheme, the new chest symbol, everything worked together. Like Sean said, this is my favorite era. I stuck with it until after the aftermath or armor wars and the perm, something at the time I thought was cool. We all have our crosses. Looking forward to comics from Aunt Marcia's house." And I still say, cool as December. Yeah, I mean, everybody could do this kind of show. I mean, as I mentioned, everyone, and Zoom Yukinuri kind of does when he talks about the comics he got from his Uncle Kenzo on his Done in One Wonder show. So I would love to hear other people's version of this. That would be fun to hear about their particular vacation comics experiences. That would be really neat. So if anybody else wants to do it, have me on. That would be really fun to talk about. We got a comment also from Ryan Daly. He says, "Great episode, guys. For a long time, I regarded the O'Neill run as, quote, Tony's low rent period between Michelini and Leighton runs, unquote. And even though I loved how O'Neill developed Rhodey, I didn't hold this period in as high esteem initially because I thought the art quality was such a step down when Luke McDonald replaced Romita Jr. and Leighton. When Bright takes over, though, it really picked up for me. I'll always prefer classic red and gold, but I do have an appreciation for the Silver Centurion armor because the first Iron Man comic I ever bought was a back issue from this era, number 222, I think. Thank you so much, Ryan. We got feedback for episode 16, which is New Teen Titans number 13 with Dan Greenfield. We got comments from Ange, Alexander Osias, Earth 2, Ido Bosnar, Boston Moss, Wardhol Terry, Chris Franklin, Mech Traver, Gothos Mansion, and Siskoid, who says, "I started on Titans much later. Many have said too late to enjoy it, but Rob's enthusiasm is such that he makes me enjoy old comics by proxy. Terry Long for never." Well, thank you, Siskoid. I appreciate that. That is kind of the point of the show. I'm glad I'm able to put that across. Tim Price says, "Like Chris Franklin, my first issue of New Teen Titans was number 15. I was just starting to collect comics then, and like many have said, being 13 let this book speak to me more than most. Plus, having Wolf and Perez at their maximum brilliance. What a great era for comics. It showed how willing I was to go with the flow in my reading, because I didn't know half of these Titans, never heard of the Doom Patrol before, and so the villains meant nothing to me either. And it didn't matter. The story handled the intros, set the stakes, so just sit back and watch it play out. Today would take two recap pages to handle all of that. Another sign of how storytelling has changed in the right-for-the-trade reality today. Thank you for pointing out how badass the women are in these Titans. That was always a hallmark for me in this iteration. The three women were easily more powerful than the four men on the team. That's a rare thing, and it was awesome. Rob certainly hit the jackpot on a month to buy comics, that's for sure. Great episode." Thank you, Tim. Yeah, I mean, when I went back and looked at all the comics that are beloved to me, so many of them come from, like, this week in comics, like August 6th or whatever. It's unbelievable. And there's even more. There's a bunch that I'm going to get to in season three that are from this date. So I must have been begging my parents for money to keep buying all these comics or something, because that was a good couple of weeks there. And then finally, we got comments on episode 17, which is Rampaging Hulk number 5 with Michael Bailey. We've got comments from Ryan Daly, Martin Gray, Brian Linton, David Gutierrez, Siskoy, Chris Franklin, Gothos Mansion, and Dr. Andrew says, "Here's what I love about the FNW network. A lot of times there are episodes about stuff I know intimately, and hearing you guys talk about it is great. But there are times you guys are talking about something I know nothing about, and I am a student listening. I know nothing about Marvel's Black and White magazines. I have never owned one. But now I know to look at the very least for this issue. My knowledge of the format is limited to the very rare early Eerie or Creepy that my older brother bought for me. As mentioned here, there were always more adult in content, and as a result, there were comics you didn't want your parents to flip through." True that, Ange. "Thanks for discussing, and great to hear you and Mr. Bailey nerding out over this." Well, I think if I get together with Mike Bailey, we can't do anything else but nerd out of whatever it is we're talking about. But yes, these magazines were, as I talked about with Gene in the opening segment, this was stuff that I had to kind of sneak by my parents a little. And luckily, they didn't stare at my comic collection too intently. Otherwise, they might have been a little concerned about some of the Warren stuff. And then we got a comment from Ado Bosnar. He says, "I only got around to listening to this today, but I have to say, great conversation, gentlemen. I never had any of the Rampaging Hulk magazines. I never even knew they existed until many years after its cancellation, and they simply did not appear in any of the magazine racks when I was growing up. I've always been fascinated by it, though, and would like to read them someday, so I really enjoy any posts or podcasts about them. Also, I'm glad you both noted how awesome Keith Pollard's art is. Yes, he is an underrated and now often quite unfairly forgotten artistic hero of comics in the 70s and 80s. He did indeed work as the regular pencil in Amazing Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, and Thor, among other assignments, often at the same time, putting him up there with Sal Buscema as a workhorse for Marvel. By the way, you guys aren't the first to speculate as to why DC never entered the black and white magazine market and what titles they could have published if they'd put their minds to it. The topic came up at the Bronze Age Babies blog a few years ago, with commenters making a lot of great suggestions: horror stories featuring the Phantom Stranger, Swamp Thing or Spectre, war stories with Sergeant Rock or the Unknown Soldier, etc. I thought, and still do think, that it would have been cool if they had done a Warlord magazine to really let Mike Grell go to town with his creation. Also, I'm surprised DC never tried to at least launch magazines for some of the pulp characters they were licensing back in the 70s, like the Shadow and the Avenger from Justice Inc. Yeah, those are all great suggestions. Warlord's particularly an interesting idea, you know. But yeah, I've never talked to anybody at DC about that. I like some of the editors. I probably should. I know some of these guys. It would be interesting to find out why they didn't do it. I mean, a Batman black and white magazine would have been really cool. So I don't know why DC never did it. I mean, it's funny. They had them and Marvel. Like, Marvel did black and white magazines, but no digests. And DC did digest, but no black and white magazines. Like, they had their turf or something. They both did treasuries. But it's very strange. So, again, thank you for the comment. And thanks, everybody, for all the comments. I've gotten a bunch of comments sort of off the record, too, saying from people how much they enjoy the show. And I really appreciate it. But, yes, we're going to wrap it up for season two here. The Mountain Comic Show just is something I feel like I need to do during warm weather. Having one in December is already later than I typically plan, but just the way it played out. So, again, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks for the comments. I really do appreciate it. I really enjoy doing the show. I'm really looking forward. I'm saying a lot of reallys here. Enjoying, anticipating getting to season three because there's a bunch of really fun comics that I want to talk about. And you know what? Memorial Day, which is kind of the initial, when I think of the beginning of Mountain Comics season, we'll be here before you know it. So thanks to all my guests. Thanks again for Gene Hendricks for coming back to talk about the Empire Encounters comics. That was a lot of fun. So if you want to leave comments, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And I promise I will read feedback for this episode in a later episode in season three. So thanks, everybody. We will see you later. Bye.